Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, August 8th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Before we jump into the interview today, I would love to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible, especially by pledging your support through patreon.com/talknerdy. I want to go ahead and thank Phil T-Bear, Stuart Ogg, Rod Adams, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and last but not least, Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you so much for your patronage. If you would like to support the show, a great way to do it is by visiting my website, and you can click through to all of the portals there. All right, guys, I'm really excited about the show this week. I had the opportunity to sit down remotely, but still sit across the country with Luke Dietrich. Now, he's the author of a new book called Patient HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. And he definitely had some secrets to share. So without any further ado, here he is, Luke Dietrich. Well, Luke, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to talking all about Patient HM.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So when does the book come out, first of all?
The book comes out on Tuesday, August 9th.
Great. So we're recording this on Friday, August 5th, but it'll air on Monday. So everybody, the book comes out tomorrow if you're listening to this the day that it drops. So it's a great time to go ahead and get it so you can keep learning about all the things we're going to discuss today. So I guess before we even talk about your relationship to the subject, before we even talk about some of the sort of interesting and dark and bizarre twists and turns to this story, maybe for everybody who's listening, we can do a little bit of a primer on who HM was, because I think most people have heard of Patient HM, they just might not know it.
Sure, yeah. So Patient HM was the most studied individual in the history of neuroscience. He was a man who received an experimental brain operation when he was 27 years old that rendered him profoundly amnesic. And ultimately, his loss was our gain. The studies conducted with him taught us a huge amount about how memory works. But he was also, before he was Patient HM, he was a man named Henry Mollison. And he grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. His dad was an electrician. His mom often worked as a housekeeper. And his story really begins, sort of the story of his transformation into Patient HM begins when he was 8 or 9 years old. He was walking home from a playground late one night in July. And a bicyclist knocked him over. He hit his head really hard. He was knocked unconscious for 5 minutes or so. And not long after that, he began having seizures. And the seizures over the years grew progressively worse, more severe, and in greater frequency. Until by the time he was in his 20s, he was really pretty incapacitated. All elements of his life were affected by it. You know, his when he graduated from high school, they didn't allow him to walk across the stage to get his diploma because they were worried that he might have a seizure and cause a scene. His work life, his professional life, everything was affected. And so he and his family grew increasingly desperate, and they wanted to figure out some way to deal with this affliction of his, and they eventually turned to a neurosurgeon who was a very sort of renowned neurosurgeon. He was the director of, or he was the chief of surgery at Hartford Hospital, the founder and chief of surgery there. He had taught at Yale. He was known to be you know, brilliant technically. And he, this surgeon offered them hope. He told them about an experimental operation he wanted to perform on Henry, removing bilaterally some of sort of his deep-seated medial temporal lobe structures, his hippocampus, amygdala, uncus. And the family, you know, in their desperation, they said yes. And the surgeon, who is my grandfather, or was my grandfather, performed the operation. It eased Henry's epilepsy somewhat, but it also had a catastrophic and unforeseen side effect. You know, from that moment forward, Henry lived the rest of his life, you know, about a half century, in 30-second increments. The present sort of slid off of him. He was, you know, he was frozen in orbit in a lot of ways.
So we know him as Patient HM. Most people who have studied basic biology, definitely neuroscience, psychology, have come across Patient HM in their textbooks, in their readings. And the reason we know him as Patient HM is because his story, or at least his clinical story, was published quite a bit during his life. And of course, ethically, it's important to protect the identity of a living patient. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
And so now, because he, of course, passed away in what, 2008?
In 2008, yes.
Now we know that his name was actually Henry. How do you pronounce his last name again?
Henry Mollison.
Mollison. Okay, it looks like Mollison's. Yeah. Henry Mollison. And now, of course, his life is becoming illuminated in many ways because of efforts like yours. So before we get more, I think, into Henry's life and, of course, some of the underbelly of the treatments and of the research that was done with Henry, I would love to talk more about your relationship to this subject. You mentioned quickly that your grandfather was actually Henry's neurosurgeon. How close were you with your grandfather?
Well, my grandfather died when I was 9 years old. And, you know, I wouldn't describe our relationship as being particularly close, but he was my grandfather, and he was this, you know, he loomed large in my childhood. He was this, you know, kind of charismatic, larger-than-life figure in a lot of ways, you know, owner of a rotating fleet of sports cars, a big world traveler, and also this kind of revered neurosurgeon. You know, as far as the family connection to the story, I feel like the story of Patient HM, and which by the way, I can't even remember when I first heard about it. It's sort of always been a part of my family lore. But it's one of those stories that I think I would have found, you know, captivating regardless of my connection to it. I mean, I think these sort of the swirling issues of memory, how memory works, amnesia, human research subjects, medical ethics, all of these things are really sort of fascinating to me to begin with. But the family connection did make it irresistible. And ever since I, you know, began to feel like writing was what I wanted to do with my life, I always knew that this was a story that eventually I was going to have to sort of confront head on and tackle.
Yeah, you know, when I talk to other science communicators and I talk to people who have written, you know, one book to many books, oftentimes they tell me that the first conversations they have with their publishers and the conversations that they have with their peers about deciding what to write and deciding how to write it is that the question you want to ask yourself is, what story can I tell that only I can uniquely tell, you know, that other people might not have the same insights, the same information, the same technique when they tell that story. And I think that that's why it's so fascinating that you did have this personal kind of familial relationship to the story of Henry, because you grew up with it in your life. It filled your consciousness from the time you were quite young.
I think that did help me figure out ways to approach the story. Mm-hmm. I will say it's also been, you know, an interesting and and not always interesting in a good way experience reporting the book, because it has sort of required me to do some pretty hard investigative journalism on my own family.
And that's how strange.
Yeah. And, you know, I've done a lot of investigative journalism in the past. And so I'm that, which means sort of in a certain sense, I'm used to causing people pain with my stories. It's an almost inevitable byproduct of certain, you know, types of stories. But usually that pain is sort of, you know, I'll do my reporting and I'll kind of lob my story like a grenade into somebody else's life. And I'm distant from it at that point. And this is a situation where, you know, I was forced to, you know, some of the things that I was digging up in the course of my reporting, I knew they were going to cause pain, and they have caused pain to some of the people I most adore, including, you know, my mother. And that's been a new experience, and it's definitely been something that I've sort of grappled with throughout the reporting on this book.
Yeah. You know, it's such a comparison, I think, that comes out in my mind, at least, when I look at your book, Patient HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. I can't help but compare it to sort of an Oliver Sacks tale meets Henrietta Lacks, because it has both of those components, the sheer fascination just of Henry's brain, you know, without any of the other sort of, I guess, drama, if you want to put it that way, is so compelling on its own. But when you combine that then with some of the medical ethics, some of the dark family secrets, and some of the investigative work that you've had to do to pull out some things that were just existing below the surface, there's a whole other layer to this story that is absolutely fascinating. I know we're not going to be able to dig as deep as we would love to with in this hour, but I am very excited about scratching that surface.
Well, thank you. And I'll just say that I am deeply flattered that you would bring up Henrietta Lacks and or The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks and Oliver Sacks, because that what a book that was. And Oliver Sacks, all of his books, I've adored. I mean, he's a hero of mine.
He's a hero of mine as well. You know, I think in many ways, he's the reason that I studied neuroscience in school and that I actually followed that path, because he made the tales of these patients of his come to life in almost it was a beyond a journalistic way. It was almost a narrative kind of fiction way. It really is like reading fiction when you read his clinical tales. And, you know, but the reason that I make those comparisons is because this story of HM, not only is it written so beautifully, but the story is so larger than life. I wonder, as an investigative journalist, was this telling of this tale, digging deep into the science, digging deep into the neuroscience, frightening for you when you first started to venture into it? Was it something where you weren't sure if you had the comfort level or where the bar felt very high?
Oh, yes, most definitely. And I don't know if I cleared that bar, but I at first it was very intimidating, just even being able to develop kind of like a basic grasp of the jargon that allows you to sort of process at a fairly basic level the journal articles that you're digging through. That was definitely a big an intimidation factor throughout the reporting of the book, because I, you know, and I am upfront about the fact that I'm not a neuroscientist. I am a layperson, and so I bring kind of a layperson's perspective to this. But, you know, I guess the advantage I had was that I had a very brilliant and a very patient editor, Andy Ward, who put up with my multiple missed deadlines, which ultimately, hopefully, allowed me to sort of expand that comfort level or acquire it, at least some basic, you know, comfort with the subject matter.
Well, and I appreciate that in the writing style, because I think that, you know, science communication comes in many forms and it comes down many paths. I do science communication from the perspective of somebody who used to do neuroscience and now does more pure journalism. But I have many friends who were journalists first and they really learned the ethics of doing good journalism and they learned how to write beautiful stories first. And then they slowly but surely, you know, started to get some of the jargon and some of the methodology behind good science. And the truth of the matter is when telling these stories where I think the character, Henry as a character, Suzanne, which we'll get to as a character, are so front and center in these stories. Honestly, that's so much more important than having this dictionary at your fingertips. The neuroscience is really secondary in a lot of ways to the human component of the story. And I think not overly focusing on the neuroscience, which is a fatal flaw that many scientists who might approach this type of storytelling make, actually makes the story come to life that much better. So I appreciate that for sure.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and I think that the story of Patient HM, it's a valuable story first and foremost because, you know, his story is valuable in the sense that he taught us so much about how memory works. But I do think that also there is a human component to his story that has been lost in the textbooks.
Telling. Yeah. This blew it blew the lid open for me when I read this. I didn't know any of the information in it. And you, of course, just recently penned a piece in the New York Times Magazine called The Brain That Couldn't Remember. This was published on August 3rd. And it, in some ways, it's like a succinct version of all the great detail that we get in this book, or at least a teaser to the book. And it's
a teaser. A complete version, yeah.
I think it's a great entree for people who are nervous, you know, maybe about taking on a neuroscience tome. It really is not that at all. It's a fascinating story. And so let's stop being so meta and talking about the about of the story, and let's dig into it a little
bit.
So you just told us a little bit about the background of Henry, but I also mentioned Suzanne. And Suzanne is also an important story or character in this story. And so maybe we can start by talking about Susan's relationship with Henry.
Sure. And actually, if you don't mind, I'm going to actually back up a little bit and talk about Suzanne's relationship with my mom, because it's one of the sort of bizarre aspects of the story is always, you know, digging up these different connections and or laying out these different connections. I remember, I think in the Esquire story I wrote an Esquire story years ago that sort of led to this book project. Suzanne was one of the people I wrote about in the Esquire story. But I think it would have been hard to just throw in there the fact that apart from being the woman who worked with Patient HM for longer than any other researcher and who sort of dominated the research on Patient HM for the last several decades of his life, and Patient HM, again, having been sort of, in some senses, created by my grandfather, that she, Suzanne Corkin, also was my mom's oldest friend. She grew up across the street from my mom and my grandfather in West Hartford, Connecticut. My mom and Suzanne went to school from, I think, third grade all the way through senior year of college together. They used to talk on tin can telephones strung between their bedroom windows when they were little. But she, oddly enough, went on to sort of inherit my grandfather's most famous patient. And she did work with him for decades. That said, and a lot of the work that she did was fascinating and compelling, and I lay it out in the book. That said, she came to the case of Patient HM after a lot of the real foundational seminal work had already mm-hmm. been done with him. There's a woman named Brenda Milner, who is this amazingly brilliant person who lives in Montreal. She's still an active researcher and professor at McGill University. I don't want to botch her age, but she's in her 90s.
And still doing research.
Yeah, no, she's just incredible. Just a quick aside about her, because I was constantly blown away by her whenever I had any sort of interactions with her. I remember at one point I was trying to like peg down the date that something happened in the 1950s. She had been, well, actually, I'm going to back up and just say who she was in the first place. So she is mm-hmm. the person who did the first real experiments with patient HM after his operation. And it was because of the work that she did with HM that the two major sort of fundamental scientific discoveries about memory that came out of, you know, research with patient HM came about. The first being that she discovered that basically his ability to create new long-term memories was severely compromised, and realizing that, tied with the fact that she knew more or less exactly what had been removed bilaterally from his brain, you mm-hmm. could then extrapolate that those structures must be essential to support long-term memory creation. Secondly, she showed through her work with patient HM that the brain must contain at least two separate and somewhat distinct memory systems, one being the sort that was severely compromised in Henry, and the other being procedural memory, sort of task learning, which Henry was not compromised on. He was able to learn new tasks, new skills, even though he could never remember the learning process itself. He would improve. Anyway, so she did this sort of seminal work with him for years. And just this story about her and my grandfather. So, the first sort of breakthrough paper about HM was one that she co-authored with my grandfather. My grandfather actually was the first author on the paper. It came out in 1957. But Brenda Milner told me, and I have no reason to disbelieve her, that she actually did most of the writing. My grandfather basically only did the surgical description, but this was the 1950s, and that's sort of how it worked.
I'm sure also he had the name recognition. So a first author, you know, him as a first author on a paper like that would get read.
Well, it could be, although he was coming at it as not as a scientist, but as a surgeon. I think it may have been one of those things where he wanted the glory a little bit.
Sure.
A little bit more, and she was willing to sort of let it slide. But anyway, so I was asking Brenda Milner about some event that took place in the 1950s, and I was asking her about a conference she had attended in Chicago in 1955, and I said, "Do you happen to know what time of year that was?" And she said, "Well, let me think about it." And she sort of looked up, and then she said, "Well, I remember that I called your grandfather, and it was his 50th birthday, to wish him a happy birthday. And I called him from a payphone somewhere in Chicago. And so it must have been January 17th, 1955. And
wow.
That's the sort of, and the you know, the, so, and she's sort of the godmother of memory research. And so it's I guess, appropriate that she has this prodigious, almost, you know, supernatural memory.
I know, that's incredible. That paper was actually written, co-authored by Dr. Milner and by your grandfather in 1957.
That's when it came out, yes.
This was the first, it was published, the first kind of preeminent, groundbreaking paper about HM, and then a lot of things followed. I wanted to clarify a couple of things with you. Prior to this, it was still known at the time that the hippocampus was likely responsible for a large amount of memory functioning. It just wasn't really well understood what type of memory or whether or not there were other memory systems and where they might be located. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, actually, Brenda Milner herself, along with Wilder Penfield, who is, you know, this was a brilliant neurosurgeon himself operating at the Montreal Neurological Institute. They had already begun to sort of zero in on the importance of these bilateral of these sort of medial temporal lobe structures. And they had done so because Wilder Penfield had been performing these surgeries to treat epilepsy unilaterally. He would attack those structures unilaterally. And in a couple cases, he would remove unilaterally these structures, and the patients would be rendered amnesic, almost as profoundly amnesic as Henry. At the time, they didn't have sort of the neuroimaging devices that would allow them to actually see what the status of the opposite hemisphere was. But they theorized that they more than likely that those other structure that the structures in the opposite hemisphere must have been damaged, as turned out to be the case when they were able to do sort of post-mortem examination. So they already sort of thought that this was going to be the case that these structures were critically important, but they didn't have proof more or less until patient HM came along, because my grandfather did what Wilder Penfield never would have done, which is remove those structures bilaterally.
In both hemispheres of the brain. Yes. Yeah, and of course there are studies were going on mice, and you can, you can glean a lot of information from that, but mice can't talk and they can't, tell you. You can look at their memory systems based on procedural memory, but semantic memory, episodic memory, they can't talk.
Exactly.
They can't tell you, they can't try and recall their past. So it's very difficult to try to figure out exactly what's going on. And of course it's unethical to do pure experimental surgery unless there is a clinical reason behind it. So the other question that I, maybe not question, but clarification that I wanted to make for anybody listening. So we're talking about a surgery that was performed by your grandfather in an effort to try to relieve some of the epileptic episodes that ultimately did destroy this very important memory center of the brain. And then after that, Brenda Milner did some of the earliest neuropsychological experiments. So those experiments, of course, are not invasive experiments. These are things like answer questions, put things in a row, move these blocks around the correct way, count backward. These types of neuropsych experiments are behavioral in nature only.
Correct. Yes.
Just wanted to be clear.
Yeah. that is correct. Yes.
Yeah. And so then after Dr. Milner laid that foundational work, when did Suzanne Corkin kind of move in?
Suzanne Corkin did her first, I may get the date wrong right now, but I think she first met Henry in 1961 or 1962 while she was pursuing her PhD at McGill University under Brenda Milner. So she moved up there. She moved to Montreal after graduating from Smith College alongside my mom. And then she moved up there, worked with Brenda Milner. Mm-hmm. And met HM there for the first time, met Henry there for the first time, and then moved from McGill down to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is where she spent the rest of her career. And ultimately, Brenda Milner had multiple interests. Henry was one of many. Her work with Henry maybe what she'll most be remembered for, but she had a lot of other interests, and so she wasn't all that concerned about sort of letting her research subject go in a certain sense. And ultimately, Suzanne Corkin kind of inherited him from Brenda Milner, and by the 1970s, the late 1970s, she really was the sort of principal point of contact for anybody who wanted to access patient HM to do experiments with him.
And did Suzanne Corkin focus her efforts anywhere else? I mean, it does seem a bit unconventional, right, that there would be a single patient with an incredibly bizarre, very similar to many of Oliver Sacks' patients. He's written multiple books detailing the behavioral outcomes of many patients with severe neurological deficits, with lesions in certain areas of the brain. But it does seem a little out of the ordinary that a researcher would be so pointedly focused on a single patient and really built their entire career around this one individual.
Well, I don't think it's fair to say that she built that that she focused entirely on patient HM. She did have additional research interests. She did, you know, she studied Alzheimer's. She studied actually psychosurgery patients as well. There were other patients that she was dealing with apart from patient HM. But she herself said that the papers that came out of her lab that generated the most attention and were certainly the ones. And were the most impactful in a lot of ways, were the ones that she wrote about patient HM. And he was, you know, he was a feather in her cap in a lot of ways. Sure. I mean, people were drawn to her lab because they knew this is where you go if you want to, you know, to work with the famous patient HM.
So it may seem a little in hindsight, because of course this is what we know her for, that this was such a singular focus, but her interests were more widespread. I just wonder if over the course of Corkin's career, the focus on Henry became more narrow. Towards the end of her career, was this, you know, kind of all-encompassing, or did she continue to do a lot of research in other areas throughout the career?
Well, she continued to have diverse research interests. That said, as you said, she was most known for patient HM, and in the last years of her career, she spent a lot of time working on a book specifically about patient HM and her sort of long-term relationship with him. And so I think that inevitably there may have been sort of a narrowing of focus on her part.
And was that book published?
Yes, it was. It's called Permanent Present Tense.
Ooh, I like the title. Mm-hmm. Was the focus of that book then incredibly clinical in nature?
You know, I guess you'd have to be the judge of that. It was written for a popular audience. But I'd say it was, you know, you'd have to be the judge of that.
I guess a better question would be, is it safe to assume that a lot of the things that ended up in your book were not in Suzanne Corkin's book?
That is definitely safe to assume. I mean, I think one of the things that constantly struck me in researching my book was that the story of patient HM in so many ways has been kind of shaped and dictated by people who had an interest in telling that story in a very particular way. I think that's sort of inevitable that would have happened. But if there's one thing that I hope my book does accomplish is it in some ways maybe liberates patient HM's story a little bit, providing kind of a new take on it.
Sure. And I think what's important is twofold. One, it humanizes Henry so that he is no longer just a series of calculations and data points, but is actually a fully fledged human who sensitive at times, who is at times exposed and maybe not always, you know, maybe sometimes taken advantage of a little bit. But beyond that, I think it also helps, especially those of us who are really interested in science and the scientific method, and sometimes I think do a disservice to science by deifying it a little bit. It helps hold up a mirror to show that ultimately these are human beings doing the science, and these are human beings with agendas and with interests. And sometimes things get lost in that. Sometimes things get buried in that for the glory of the data. And I think it's important to make sure that we look at this incredibly journalistically and we get all the details, not just the details that that tell a pretty and storybook type story.
I completely agree. I think that there's there are lots of problems that I think almost inevitably must crop up whenever you have such an intense and long-term sort of relationship between a researcher and a damaged research subject. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Howard Eichenbaum, who's a neuroscientist at Boston University, who had a chance to do some work with patient HM at Corkin's lab. But he's done most of his work throughout his career on, you know, working with rats. And he said, you know, I can always just buy more rats. There's only one patient HM. And patient HM becomes the source of so much data, becomes the source of so much of, you know, what you build your career out of, that it's almost inevitable that over time, the researchers, or, you know, the lead researcher in this case being Suzanne Corkin, develop almost a sense of ownership over that damaged human being. And, you know, and Eichenbaum said that. He said, you know, you can't really own another human being, but in a sense, they do own those patients. And so they want to control access to them. They want to, you know, maintain that sort of privileged position that they hold over them. And I think, unfortunately, I'm not quite sure how you solve that state of affairs, but I think it can lead to, you know, a little murkiness and lines being crossed that shouldn't.
Sure. It's almost, it's almost a bit dehumanizing, although sometimes that is what makes for such a good researcher, is having the ability to take the human emotion out of it, to be able to look at things more rationally, more clinically. You hear this from physicians all the time, trying to balance that bedside manner and that human emotion with being able to just look at the data and make decisions that are clean and pure. It's a very difficult thing to do. And especially, obviously, later when we talk about Henry's actual physical brain, you know, because eventually he did pass away and his brain was obviously a gold mine. You know, individuals wanted to study it. And when you talk about a brain, you can start talking about ownership. When you talk about lab rats, you can talk about ownership, but it does become much more difficult when you're talking about a human being who maybe isn't, I guess, was he throughout the course of his life considered to be in a psychological state where was he, quote, of sound mind to be able to sign paperwork, or did he have to have somebody with power of attorney ever since the surgery?
Right. I mean, that's something I go into at sort of pretty great depth in the book. Mm-hmm. It's the notions of informed consent. One of the fascinating things about the story of patient HM is that his case straddles such an immense period of time. I mean, it straddles a half century. And, you know, at the time that my grandfather removed those parts of Henry's brain, modern notions of informed consent really didn't exist.
And this was a time when was the lobotomy still happening? I mean, this was a very different time in neurosurgery.
It was, and that's also something that has been not entirely ignored, but certainly glossed over. Is that really the story? Even though the story of patient HM and the story of kind of what my grandfather did to him is impossible to understand without also understanding the story of the rise of the lobotomy in America, which my grandfather was a leading figure in. He was one of the most prolific lobotomists of all time. And in the years leading up to the operation he performed on Henry, he, along with a number of other sort of leading researchers and neurosurgeons and scientists, were, you know, engaged in what's hard not to describe as sort of a campaign of human experimentation, where they were, you know, performing these sort of brain lesioning experiments on human beings that had, up until very recently, only been performed on chimpanzees. There was, another neurosurgeon of the time who would have been, you know, he was a little older, but still sort of a peer of my grandfather's, who was engaged in very similar work. I opened the book, or one of the sort of opening quotes of the book is a quote from him. His name is Paul Busey. And he, I found in his archives a letter that he had written shortly after he had begun lobotomizing people. And he wrote, and he had up until recently been doing a lot of work with primates, and he said, man is certainly no poorer as an experimental animal merely because he can talk. And I found that chilling as soon as I read it. And that attitude was, dominant at the time. I mean, another thing that another letter I stumbled across in an archive that also sort of shook me was one written by John Fulton, who is the former head of the Department of Physiology at Yale University. Real, top tier scientist. Also an interesting sort of Renaissance figure. He was good friends with everyone from Robert Oppenheimer to Thornton Wilder. But he wrote to a researcher that he knew, trying to convince him to go spend some time with my grandfather, who at that time was engaged in this sort of like campaign of experimental lobotomies. And he said, I really suggest you go there. Dr. Scoville has been given unlimited access to the psychiatric material of this particular asylum. And I had to read that twice to realize that they were talking about, psychiatric material means human beings in that case. Mm-hmm. And the operation that he performed on Henry was not the first time that he had performed that operation on a human being. He had performed the same operation, with minor differences, on other people before, but those people had been deeply disturbed, sort of backwards asylum dwellers. And so their memory dysfunction, which did exist, nobody even noticed it until years later when Brenda Milner, after she met with HM, went on this sort of, odyssey into the various asylums to meet with these people that my grandfather had operated on, and found that, lo and behold, yes, they also were profoundly amnesic. But they weren't, they had so much other dysfunction that nobody had noticed. That's what made ultimately Henry so important, was that his amnesia was pure in a sense. He had a mind unmuddied by mental illness or other problems. This long kind of era of fairly radical human experimentation did in some ways kind of culminate with this operation that he performed on patient HM.
And of course, this was not just the time of lobotomies and of this type of experimental surgery, but also this was the time of, as you said, the asylum. This was prior to the closing of the asylums. This was prior to Haldol. This was when a lot of very, very sick people were kind of kept behind closed doors, and the public just generally didn't have access. They didn't see the kind of illness, like intense schizophrenia, different types of delusions that we, I think, are a little more familiar with now.
That's true. And I do try to, in the book and in general, I try not to engage in too much presentism. It is easy to, be aghast at the past. And, looking back 5-10 years, you might be horrified by what we were doing. But certainly you go back 6 decades. And again, it's very easy to sort of stand in judgment.
But we only knew what we knew.
Exactly. We only knew what we knew. They were very desperate times. And to be mentally ill and to be institutionalized in the 1930s, 1940s, early 1950s in the United States, even if the lobotomy, the reason there was the rise of the lobotomy was because there was no easy solution. And some of the other treatments that were, being implemented at the time may not have been as irreversible or quite as terrible as the lobotomy, but they were still pretty harrowing treatments to begin with. And I had to sort of confront that when, I discovered in the course of my book that my grandfather's passion for the lobotomy, there were a lot of passionate lobotomists at the time, but again, my grandfather was one of the most active and energetic lobotomists ever. But his passion for the procedure, his passion for what they called psychosurgery, grew out of this very personal goal that he had. My grandmother, his wife, was herself mentally ill, and she was herself institutionalized in an asylum for a period of time. And he viewed himself as being on this sort of personal quest to devise a surgical solution to madness so that, he could hope to one day fix her.
And it makes you wonder how often that kind of motivation is present. You know, you talk to a lot of physicians even now, even in present day, or a lot of people who work in psychology, and they have deeply personal reasons for going into the field. They, you know, ultimately may or may not shape the direction that they go, but it's not uncommon for people to feel a very personal pull to medicine or to biomedical research. And it's fascinating that, of course, then Henry Mollison becomes this this central figure in history at the hand of your grandfather, but also at the hand of Suzanne. And so kind of coming back around to that, why don't we talk a little bit about Dr. Suzanne Corkin and Henry's their relationship?
Sure. So they, you know, they it was inevitably a very one-sided relationship. She knew Henry. Henry didn't know her. She knew him intimately. She knew more about Henry than you probably know about some of the people closest to you, because that was her job. It was her job to know, you know, everything from his capacity to endure pain to his ability, you know, to eat multiple meals in a row, to, you know, figure out what bits of sort of stray information actually could stick despite his amnesia.
And deeply personal things too, right? Yeah. You know, his, what can he remember? What can't he? What's his relationship like with his family? What about sex? What about, you know, fears and all of these things that we don't often ask somebody on a first or even 40th date?
Yes. No, no. So she had this, in some senses, extremely intimate relationship with him. I mean, she knew a great deal about him, but he really didn't know the first thing about her.
Yeah, he likely didn't even remember that she exists.
Right. And although, and this is one of the fascinating things about Henry, is that his amnesia was not complete. Little things would stick and little sort of associations would build up over the years. And, you know, sometimes he would, when people would ask her, well, who's Suzanne Corkin? Or when she would ask him who Suzanne Corkin was or who she herself was, he might say that, you know, that they may have gone to high school together or that there was some degree of familiarity there. I have an exchange in the book where somebody, you know, asks him who Suzanne Corkin is, and he says, "Oh, well, she's a senator." And I think that she did acquire this sort of, I don't know, authority figure aura in his mind, but it was a very sort of like everything else with Henry, it was a very vague feeling that he had, just like he had sort of a vague feeling that time had passed since the operation, but he couldn't pinpoint exactly how much time had passed. He knew that there was something wrong with his memory, but he couldn't really describe it. Henry, you know, viewed everything through this odd sort of haze. He was, you know, one of the more poignant things about Henry is, you know, if you asked him to sort of describe his state of mind, he would say, well, it's sort of like I'm just always waking up from a dream. And, and I think we all recognize that feeling when you're just waking up from a dream and you're not entirely in the real world and you're not entirely asleep either. You're sort of, you know, grasping to root yourself again in consciousness.
And that's a common expression I've seen of individuals with anterograde amnesia, individuals who might have a past, but don't really have much of a present, and or their past exists from the point of injury prior. But they, you know, they might have lost, if it's been 10 years since the injury, those 10 years, they haven't been forming new memories. And I remember watching a video on patients. It might have even been on HM when I was in, you know, graduate school, and seeing notebooks just filled with journal entries, waking up for the first time, just now awake.
Yeah.
Wondering where I've been. I've been asleep for so long, but now I'm finally awake. And it's so just heartbreaking to see.
Yeah, those sound like the journals kept by Clive Waring, who's also a British amnesiac. It is heartbreaking to imagine what that
it's
would
heartbreaking
be like.
and it's echoed in many individuals who have this type of damage. But of course, each individual's brain is so very different, and their amnesia is so different. And Henry's was very particular to him.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And so, you know, we haven't, I feel like we've laid some really great groundwork and we've been talking for so long, and I want to make sure that before we end the interview, we get to at least some of the meat.
Sure.
I don't want you to give everything away, but I want people who are listening to understand some of those real ethical, you know, we talked a little bit about the psychosurgery and some of the, you know, straddling the line of ethics at that time, but this idea of informed consent, both before and after death, I think becomes very hazy in this story, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I sort of wandered off after we began talking about the informed consent issues. So, as I said, you know, at the beginning of his case, he, you know, modern notions of informed consent didn't really exist. Mm-hmm. They did, you know, during his lifetime, they did eventually. And he, at first, his parents were basically the ones who would consent to the experiments conducted by, you know, first Brenda Milner and then Suzanne Corkin at MIT. By 1981, I'm trying to remember if it was 1981 or 1982, his mom was actually a couple years prior to her own death. She was suffering from dementia, and Henry then moved with his mom into the home of a woman in Hartford who sort of took care of them for some time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a brief period of time then when Henry's mom could no longer sign his informed consent forms. When he would go sometimes for as long as a month at a time to MIT and just sort of live at the laboratory there for people to, you know, perform experiments with him.
Wow.
Yeah. So there was so this is now into the early 1980s. His mom is no longer really in the picture. She dies in, I think, 1982. The woman that had sort of taken in Henry and his mom then begins signing some of the informed consent forms for Henry on Henry's behalf when she drives him to MIT. Then she dies in 1982, I believe. Henry at that point has moved into a nursing home, assisted living facility, where he will live until his death in 2008. There's a period of time between about 1982 and 1992, so basically a decade, where Henry is the only person signing his informed consent forms when he goes to MIT. This is something that I think a lot of people would find troubling, because again, this is a man who you know, he can hold on to the present moment for about 30 seconds.
He's also the page.
Right, exactly. And apart from his amnesia, I think people need to bear in mind that he had other deficits. And, you know, apart from the hippocampal lesions, he also, his amygdala is removed bilaterally. And when you are missing an amygdala, I mean, one of the side effects of that is that you become more passive, you become more docile, tractable, you become sort of neurologically predisposed to consent to almost anything at that point.
Yeah, you don't have an ability to sense danger, to become angry. Like, you're very,
exactly. So you become
easily
sort of
coerced.
Very easily coerced. And if somebody asks you to sign something, and you're more than likely going to sign it at that point. So there, I think that there are serious questions about this period of time when Henry was the only person providing his own consent. Nevertheless, MIT continued to do a lot of experiments with him during that window. Then Suzanne Corkin, ultimately, she and the MIT lawyers decide that it is important to actually get somebody to become Henry's conservator, who can then consent on Henry's behalf, which is something that's a common thing, and that would be fine had she gone about finding the proper conservator. The man,
like the next of kin.
Exactly, which is typically who the conservator would be. And so the man who became Henry's conservator presented himself as Henry's next of kin. As it turned out, he was not Henry's next of kin. The man who presented himself was Henry's third cousin. And Henry had multiple first cousins living nearby at the time who had lost track of Henry, who didn't, you know, were not close with him, but they were never consulted. And, you know, their name, they had, one of them at least had the same last name and was living quite nearby. And it sort of strains belief that they couldn't have found these people. Now I asked
because you found them. I mean, that's the real issue here, right? Is that you are the one who discovered that his quote next of kin was actually indeed his third cousin, and that he had a first cousin living at the time.
That's correct. Multiple first cousins. One of whom is still alive, and they were all very surprised to hear about you know, a lot of elements of Henry's case, including what we can get into, which is that the first thing that the conservator did do, the next of kin who was not the next of kin, one of the first things he did after the court appointed him as conservator was to use that authority to donate Henry's brain in advance of Henry's death to MIT and Mass General. Henry co-signed that brain donation form, but again, it was the conservator's signature there at the bottom where he signed saying, "I, Henry's next of kin, have the authority to donate Henry's brain," yada yada. Which became sort of a crucial document down the line after Henry died, when what really amounted to a custody war over Henry's brain broke out. And ultimately that document, signed by the next of kin who was not the next of kin, became the basis for the brain being taken away from a researcher who it had sort of resided with for a time after Henry's death.
And who did a lot of important preservation and important, I guess, who uncovered some important things about Henry's brain.
Correct. Yeah, he was, he is a neuroanatomist. He at the time was at the University of California, San Diego, and Suzanne Corkin had sort of helped select him to take Henry's brain after Henry died to begin this very ambitious, archiving project, basically, where his brain was first a year after Henry's death. His brain was sliced into 2,401 extremely thin slices. It was sort of a combination between sort of a research project and publicity stunt. It was live streamed to the world, and something like 400,000 people tuned in to watch. And he, his goal was ultimately this combination of sort of histology and digital preservation. He wanted to create this sort of online, open access archive of Henry's brain, which would combine sort of slides with digital imagery, with a sort of 3D map of the brain that you could zoom in and out of, and all of that, to allow the research on Henry in a certain sense to continue. Because I mean, Henry's a guy who Henry was a man who had more sort of clinical data built on his case than almost anyone in history, and so the idea was to create sort of this equivalently ambitious repository of biological data, and you could then go back and compare and contrast.
Which, of course, in theory is incredible to have this open source, like you said, repository that researchers for years to come could look at. Maybe there's somebody who specializes in a very particular structure in the brain that wasn't studied previous to this, and they see some sort of anomaly that nobody else has seen before, and they learn something very new about how the brain functions. The problem is, other than the fact that soon after there was kind of this custody battle that you describe, I think that that maybe it's a good point, because it's the, in many ways, the closing of your New York Times Magazine piece, that it could be sort of, as we wind down our interview here, the problem with this is that you would need to be able to cross-reference that with the actual clinical data, with the actual neuropsychological outcomes that were described throughout Henry's life. And unfortunately, in an interview that you had with Suzanne towards the end of her life, the ability to do that became questioned.
That's correct. I mean, there were a lot of shocking moments during my reporting of this book, but certainly one of the most shocking was when I was in Suzanne Corkin's office, and I asked her what she planned to do with the data that she had accumulated, the HM data that she had accumulated over the course of her career. And she told me that she had shredded quite a bit of it quite recently, and that a lot of the remaining data she also seemed to intend to shred. And we got into it a little bit. I asked her how she could possibly do that, and she had a number of explanations, none of which really satisfied me. I mean, she said that there was no place to put the data. She said that that the journal articles were all that mattered, that once you had the journal articles that were all peer-reviewed, you didn't need the data itself, which to me I found... I mean, you know better than I do, but the journal articles are just sort of the tip of the iceberg of the data.
Sure, it's only the things that she, as a curator, or those of her collaborators, would choose to publish. And so usually it's only positive data, first of all. It's not null data. It's not, when you think there might be something and then it turns out to not be a thing. People never publish that. And on top of that, who knows if there were anomalies that she just never got to.
Correct. And so I think that there was something really, tragic about the notion of this HM, this sort of seminal HM data being gone forever.
Not just tragic, it really straddles the line between a tragedy and something that's more nefarious. It really does. I'm sure it's difficult for you to say and for you to editorialize about that. And it's sort of up to the reader of the book and up to individuals who want to do their own research. But what could the motivation possibly be? It seems hard to think that it's simply a neutral motivation, that it really is just, I don't have room for it. So, there's room for it. Somebody would take this data. So the question really is, like, what is being covered up here?
Yeah, I mean, what I told Suzanne is I said, somebody might come to the conclusion, hearing that you've been shredding HM's data, that what you're ultimately doing is locking in stone forever your telling of HM's story. The narrative kind of comes to an end when you do that. There's no more. You can't continue to question. The data's gone, and sort of the story's then set in stone. She said, she said, well, people like you might say that, but I don't think scientists would say that. I don't know. I'm very curious to hear from scientists. I spoke with a number of scientists who were actually quite appalled by the idea that HM's data would be shredded. One of the things that I do hope is that, and I know that Suzanne, because I got access to data that was not in Suzanne's possession. She may have had copies of it, but other copies existed. One of the things I hope is that maybe as the news circulates about Suzanne's shredding of her data, maybe some of the other scientists who worked with HM over the year, who kept bits and pieces of the raw data, maybe they will be inspired to come together and pool a repository of the remaining data, which could then be archived and indexed and perhaps used down the line, again in tandem with the foundation of this sort of biological archive that has been built out of his brain.
Sure, because she wasn't, of course, the only scientist who had access to him. She was just had the most access to him.
Yes.
But you would hope that if the neuropsychological methods were sound, that if there were things that were discovered about his behavior, that you could then make judgments about his neuroanatomy or his neurophysiology, that anybody could make the, you know, any trained neuroscientist or neuropsychologist would be able to make similar judgments. But the reason that this is so heartbreaking, I think, is that, as you pointed to in your New York Times magazine piece, we've already found new information. You know, the scientist that you referred to who made those histological slides found a lesion in the frontal lobe of HM's brain, which would have profound effects on the way that you would interpret any of his neuropsych findings, and which was not interpreted during the course of his time as a subject for Suzanne. So right there, we already know. It's not just that there's a potential for this to happen. It did happen, and it could potentially happen more.
Well, that is correct. I mean, there was a resistance on the part of Suzanne Corkin's on the part of Suzanne Corkin to even sort of release the information about the frontal lesion. And as you say, if there were this frontal lesion that was not created after his death, that was present for some indeterminate time during his lifetime, then that does call for a reexamination of old data. And unfortunately, maybe a lot of that data no longer exists.
It's really hard to re-examine, you know, if you don't have access to the raw data, if all you have
are the journal articles that they weren't looking for frontal dysfunction, you know.
No, and all you're going to see is the outcome of these psychological measures. You're going to see scaled scores. You're not going to see raw data. So it's very difficult to go backward and try and reinterpret when you don't have that core data.
I agree.
Oh, it really is heartbreaking, you know, and it makes you feel both for the science, which, don't get me wrong, there is a wealth of information that we now know because this man existed, because he endured what he endured, and because he was so willing, whether it was fully consensual or not, to share his story and to share his struggles with the scientific and now, I think, the lay public, with the world. We did learn so much, but it is so heartbreaking to know that we could know more and that maybe the road to knowing more could have been in some ways a little bit more humane and a little bit smoother. And it's, I don't know, it's just a fascinating tale. And I'm so glad that you shared it with us.
Well, thank you so much, Kara. That means a lot. I'm glad you liked it. And I'm happy to share.
That's so great. And thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and chat with me. I know I've already been with you for longer than an hour, so I need to release you. But I would love to ask you, I always close my episode the same way. I ask everyone the same two questions. And when I don't do it, I get, you know, flack from my from my audience. So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you as well. They're kind of big picture, so hang on to your hat.
Okay.
A little bit. All right, so we'll start with the one that's a little more depressing, so we can end on an upbeat. But I always want to know from each of my interviews, when you think about the future, and that's in whatever context that seems pertinent to you, whether it's your own personal life or whether it's, you know, big existential kind of global thoughts, first, what is the thing that really you are most concerned about? What keeps you up the most at night? What really does worry you about the future? But then on the flip side of that, the next question would be, what are you hopeful for and really optimistic about?
Those are very good and very big questions. You know, I can't help. But and maybe I shouldn't talk politics. I don't want to alienate.
Well, I mean, now would be the climate for it, right?
I don't want to alienate any listeners. But I guess the thing that worries me most, his initials are DJT. But I think that working on this book, one of the things that it taught me is that even when the people are capable of doing terrible things, not realizing at all that they're terrible. And I certainly think that it makes me wonder, you know, what we're doing today that we're going to be appalled by tomorrow, which is maybe maybe it's not directly answering the question, but it's one of those things that sort of constantly cropped up with me, just in terms of, you know, making me think about the future. Think about trying to sort of take a more kind of, I don't know, clear-eyed view of the present. Sure. As far as what I'm optimistic about, you know, lots of things. I mean, I do think that the climate or the sort of, I don't know, the medical and academic and research climate that gave birth to Patient HM back in the 1950s, I do think that we've advanced far beyond that. And I think that we're on the cusp of all sorts of, you know, amazing revelations. I mean, it's still how the mind works is still kind of one of our biggest questions, and not that we'll ever fully answer it, but I do think that there are just in terms of the subject matter in the book, that there are a lot of things perhaps just on the horizon, but a lot of things to be concerned about too. I personally think that those sort of neural sort of do-it-yourself stimulating devices that are kind of a fad now. I mean, I think those are just terrifying. Because nobody knows what the long-term effects of just sort of jolting yourself repeatedly like that is going to be.
But we do know that the short-term effects can be pretty awful as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely when you don't do it right and you don't do it under clinical supervision. I did an entire thing about these for a TV show that I work for, and it was horrifying to see these DIYers with third-degree burns on their head hooking these things up to a wall outlet instead of using a low-voltage battery. Just crazy.
Try them yourself?
I did, but I tried it under supervision. You know, with the little wet sponges, and I did it in a lab atmosphere, and I did a pre-test and a post-test. I actually did poorer after the it was called direct current stimulation. TDCS, transcranial direct current stimulation. I actually did poorer after. So I was not the best test subject. But yeah, it actually felt like nothing to me. So in my mind, it kind of just seemed like pseudoscience. But beyond that, maybe there are long-term effects that could be damaging. Yeah. I mean, they could be good, but they could be really damaging.
Exactly.
You're right.
Exactly, yeah. Anyway, that's just one thing to throw out there.
Of course. And I think even based on what you said at the beginning, this idea of what are we doing now that could be considered immortal in the future, we have ethicists saying things like, and I'm a culprit, I'm a Texan, I eat red meat constantly, but people saying, gosh, in the future, the idea of eating animals is going to be horrifying to us.
Oh, I can see that being the case, but yeah. I'm not ready to give up steak.
I'm not either. Yeah. Well, Luke, okay, his name is Luke Dietrich. The book is Patient HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. It's out on Monday, August 8th, and I'm sure you can get it at your local bookstore or, of course, in any of the big box places as well. Luke, thank you so much for joining me. And before you go, why don't you let everybody know, do you have a website? Are you on social media? Where can they reach out to you?
I have a very sleepy Twitter account that I never use. It is Luke Dietrich, but I don't really use it. I should, hopefully, my plan is to actually get up at least a very quick website before the book comes out. I do have the website lukedietrich.com, so maybe I'll have a way for people to contact me there. But I'm sorry, I'm not very accessible by social media.
We'll force you into it. You'll see.
Okay,
you'll wake up. Yeah. You'll open your Twitter account on Tuesday, and you'll see that there are so many people. And
it's an egg right now. So
it's an egg. Oh yeah, that's not a good sign.
No.
By the way, did I say Tuesday, August 9th, or did I say Tuesday, August 8th? Because it's August 9th.
August 9th.
In case if I got that wrong.
August 9th is correct. Tuesday, August 9th.
Yeah. So everybody, I highly recommend the book. And Luke, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this this fascinating story with us today.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate this.
Of course. And everyone listening, thank you so much for tuning in week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.